All right, you might be wondering, like I did when I was invited to do this, why are they asking a philosopher to get involved in this this debate or this sort of discussion? I gather the idea was that I should present some deep thoughts, right? So that's what people expect from philosophers. So kind of sit back in your chair, and I'll try to give you some deep thoughts. Okay, here we go. Beginning all the way back with the ancient Greeks. Told you, you know, we're going to we'll get away from the Greeks very quickly, I promise you. Thinkers in the West long engaged in a twofold search for understanding. On the one hand, they wanted a theoretical understanding of the world, its various parts and how they operate. And then they wanted a practical or moral understanding of human purpose and meaning. And this division of theoretical and practical understanding did not correspond to our modern division between empirical science, on the one hand, and speculative metaphysics or religion, on the other. For when it came to theoretical understanding itself, the explanations that they offered blended together what we nowadays think of as empirical and philosophical or metaphysical notions and theories. These two were fused. This is reflected in the term that they used for that enterprise of natural philosophy, a term that was used right up through and even beyond Newton's day at the end of the 17th century. Beginning in the late Middle Ages, though, natural philosophers slowly learned how to disentangle purely empirical issues, the kinds that can be settled by, or at any rate be well confirmed by empirical evidence, by observation and testing, from thoroughly philosophical questions about the existence and nature of the world on both micro and macro scales. This process took off dramatically in the 16th century with the groundbreaking work of Galileo and others, and eventually culminated in Newton's grand achievement of a well-confirmed set of laws of motion and a theory of universal gravitation. Importantly, the deeply religious Newton separated his empirical theories and methods from traditional attempts to give ultimate or metaphysical explanations of what we observe. Consider his famous statement in the Scholium, appended to his famous work, The Principia. Sorry, I thought there might be, I don't know how many faculty biologists were here, so I threw in a little, you know, kind of historical stuff. If you're bored by this, I'll try to move quickly. But he has a famous statement in Latin, hypotheses non fingo, I feign no hypotheses. Or in context, here's what he said in context, I have not as yet been able to discover the reason for these properties of gravity from phenomena, and I do not feign or frame hypotheses. For whatever is not deduced from the phenomena must be called a hypothesis. And hypotheses, whether metaphysical or physical, or based on occult qualities or mechanical, have no place in experimental philosophy. In this philosophy, that is his experimental philosophy, particular propositions are inferred from the phenomena and afterwards rendered general by induction. What exactly Newton meant by this claim is very unclear, especially since elsewhere in the work he advances what he himself calls hypotheses and gives evidence. So it's a little bit unclear exactly what he was saying here, but for our purposes, Newton's slogan, I feign no hypotheses, can stand for an orientation of science away from questions of metaphysics that are, you know, eternally disputed, an orientation that endures to the great evident profit of science. The power of the explanations offered by Newton and subsequent scientific figures derived in part from this self-limitation, from scientists restricting themselves to quantifiable, dynamical laws with no pretense to explaining why such laws obtained, save through derivation from or grounding in yet more fundamental laws that would themselves be unexplained, right? But the way science is formulated, at the end of the day, you're going to have unexplainable ultimate laws, right? And it's not the business of science to try to give some kind of metaphysical account of why is the world structured in that way. Great power and progress comes, we've learned, from a certain modesty of aim. Right? When science began to just set aside those kind of metaphysical questions, Newton didn't worry about when people said, well, you posit action at a distance, that seems inconceivable. How could two separated spatial objects literally instantaneously affect one another? All he knew was he could give beautiful laws of motion that talked about instantaneous covariation, and it explained things beautifully, gave an elegant account of what we observed. He said, well, I don't care about the metaphysical issues. The flip side, though, of this kind of orientation of science away from metaphysics is that by its very methods, it's unsuited to answer certain kinds of questions. Familiarly, this includes questions of meaning and value, as Jeff has alluded to, but also whether there is a reality more fundamental than physical reality. Now, you may be a scientist, and you may happen to think that the success of science at giving a deeply unified picture of the cosmos renders the existence of God or other metaphysical views unlikely or implausible. But whatever argument you'd favor here, that you would advance here from the success of science to the likely non-existence of such entities, it won't be a scientific argument, but a philosophical one. And just as philosophers notoriously make bad amateur scientists, well, the reverse of that is also true. I'll resist the temptation to name names. It should also be recognized that science must make big starting assumptions that cannot themselves be independently justified, such as, just one among many, the assumption that all science makes that there is uniformity to the fundamental processes governing the evolution of the world, thereby permitting reliable inductions from what we observe to what is unobserved. Right? It's just a fundamental assumption that animates science. There is that kind of regularity. You can't give a scientific justification for that assumption without begging the question. Trust me. I won't try to argue that point. Anyways, my point is that, yes, it's true that some Christians' deep suspicion of certain scientific theories, such as the neo-Darwinian synthesis in biology, stems in part from a failure to appreciate what the project of science is all about. Why it considers, for example, only naturalistic hypotheses and theories of a certain kind. But what is less often observed is that the loud declaration by some secular scientist that the success of science has shown the intellectual bankruptcy of all significant religious claims equally rests on a misunderstanding of science, ironically, because they're scientists. That's a familiar phenomenon, right? People, practitioners of, in any kind of creative or intellectual field often aren't the best people to go to for a kind of an illuminating account of that field in a wider context, right? They're so immersed in it, you know, they're like the proverbial fish in water, and sometimes scientists say just ridiculous things about science itself, you know. I know that may sound shocking, I'm not a scientist, but it's really true. So, you know, in this case, you know, the built-in explanatory limits, some scientists, not all, many scientists are very intellectually modest and recognize the limits of science, but the ones you hear about most often very often don't recognize these built-in limitations. That the world is deeply unified, having a natural causal integrity of its own that can be studied in purely naturalistic terms, is just what many Christian thinkers have long assumed must be the case. The medieval philosopher theologian Thomas Aquinas, long before Darwin, for example, said that we shouldn't appeal to God as the direct, entire cause of this or that specific phenomena, except, you know, putting aside special cases of miracles, right, but not as a kind of general purpose explanation for why a type of phenomena occurs. Instead, we should think of God as the cause of causes, responsible in a timeless fashion for the world's very existence and having the general character that it does. In the same vein, the great mathematician and philosopher Leibniz, himself a devout Lutheran, expressed this sort of view. Here's what he said about Newton's notorious hypothesis that God intervenes periodically in the course of nature to keep the planetary orbits from getting derailed. This was something that Newton had thought was necessary based on his detailed calculations. It looked like gradually these things would start wobbling out of their orbits. So he said, oh, okay, so periodically God makes an adjustment, right, and puts them back into their orbit. A century later, the famous physicist, mathematician Laplace showed that Newton was just mistaken, right? There was no need for that. So here's what Leibniz, a contemporary of Newton, said about Newton's theological appeal to explain a regular phenomenon in the world. Sir Isaac Newton and his followers also have a very odd opinion concerning the work of God. According to their doctrine, God Almighty needs to wind up his watch from time to time. Otherwise, it would cease to move. He had not, it seems, sufficient foresight to make it a perpetual motion. Nay, the machine of God's making is so imperfect, according to these gentlemen, that he is obliged to clean it now and then by an extraordinary concourse, and even to mend it. By contrast, he said, according to my opinion, the same force and vigor remains always in the world and only passes from one part of matter to another agreeably to the laws of nature and the beautiful pre-established order. And I hold that when God works miracles, he does not do it in order to supply the needs of nature, but those of grace. Whoever thinks otherwise must have a very crude notion of the wisdom and power of God. So this is, you know, again, a pre-Darwinian expression, theologically rooted expression of the idea that we should expect regularity in the world, that we should expect the ability to give the kinds of accounts, naturalistic accounts of phenomena as they unfold in the world, for all aspects of the world, right? Now, something that neither Aquinas nor Leibniz nor anyone else prior to the late 18th century foresaw was the possibility of gradual cosmic and biological evolution within a unified world brought about by God. But once the idea is placed on the table, one having Leibniz's general attitude could easily come to think that a dynamical universe, leading gradually from a relative chaos to pockets of ordered complexity, permitting living systems, is just the sort of thing that would commend itself to an infinitely wise creator, right? The universe as a machine-making machine, right? There's something very elegant about that. As to biological natural selection in particular, well, why wouldn't God choose that very elegant mechanism for bringing about diverse forms of life? It really is a beautiful, elegant mechanism. Is it that he wouldn't have enough time to wait for its fruition? That's why God would never choose to use such a means. Or that he would have limited resources so that he would need to carefully conserve, and so need to use a more efficient method? I mean, sometimes some critics, right, say, well, evolution shows that God, it's very unlikely, doesn't exist. Why? Well, because it would be such a wasteful, inefficient way to bring about living things. They said, you know, we care about efficiency. We have limited resources, right? We have limited time. We don't want to waste time doing things. Timeless God, omnipotent God, having infinite resources, doesn't expend energy. You know, efficiency is not a category that sensibly applies to God and would constrain God. So I've made my point. There are issues, which I can't talk about here, concerning the compatibility of God's perfect goodness with animal and human suffering. And we could have a good long discussion of that. But theists have to confront the problem of suffering, whatever their view of the mode of creation. And the essentials of the matter, I suggest, will remain the same. Well, that's a very high-level view of the matter, typical of a philosopher. But what of the reality on the ground, you might ask, when it comes to the centuries-long battle between science and religion, and Christianity in particular? I'm already pretty much out of time, so I'm just going to sound a couple of themes quickly, make a set of assertions, really, that we can later pick up on, if you like, in the discussion. The, quote, long and irreconcilable conflict, portrayal of the history of science and Christianity, is a complete myth. Serious present-day historians of the subject, who mostly know better, trace it back to the late 19th century historians John William Draper, who wrote a very influential textbook, and Andrew Dixon White, who was the first president of Cornell University, where I was a graduate student, and big statue of him right in the center of campus. And he was very proud of the fact that Cornell was the only Ivy League university founded as a non-religious institution, had a lot of animosity towards Christianity. He wrote a book, A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, in 1896. The book is thoroughly discredited by serious historians of science and religion, secular and religious alike. Nobody takes it seriously as a lasting contribution to the discussion, but it's still in press with Prometheus Press, which is sort of the rough equivalent, the non-religious equivalent of InterVarsity Press, right? And I think a lot of people, they buy, it's a big 1,000-page tome. I doubt very many people who buy it actually read it, but, you know, it's got that title right there, A History of the Warfare of Science, and it just kind of expresses that kind of attitude. It's amazing how often that falsehood and myth-filled
book is still cited by respectable, educated people who should know better, by folks such as Richard Dawkins likes to cite that book. There have been two points of significant conflict, science-religion conflict. First Galileo, then Darwin. There's lots to say about both of them, including noting several more myths about how those particular events have unfolded. I can't talk about that here, but maybe in the discussion I can elaborate a bit. A point that needs to be grasped, though, if you want to understand what's going on, why were these such flashpoints, why were there big battles over these matters, is a point that needs to be grasped concerning both Galileo's controversy with the Catholic theologians and the Protestant, most largely the Protestant reaction to Darwin, which was not uniformly negative to begin with. That's something that most people actually... Opposition to Darwin hardened over time. Initially, there were many very staunch Orthodox Protestant theologians and others who accepted, who embraced the biological theory of evolution just based on the evidence. But then there was a changing tide of opinion in evangelical circles. I can't trace that history here. But in both of those controversies, historical context played a huge role in why those episodes played out as they did. In both cases, there was a backdrop of theological controversy independent of the science issues. And when it comes to the aftermath in the 20, 30 years after Darwin published The Origin of Species, there was also moral controversy that was bound up with people's understanding of the theory of evolution. Wrongly, I think, but nonetheless a prevalent kind of view. And where theological or moral controversy raged, narrowly constricted biblical interpretation regularly follows, alas. This says less about Christian theology itself than it does about human nature. When under siege, hunker down, right? And I think that explains a lot about what happened. There was the Protestant Reformation was the backdrop a whole century before Galileo, but it informed the way the Catholic Church came to view the issue of biblical interpretation. And to put it in a nutshell, they view Galileo as acting like a Protestant, thinking he could interpret the Bible, offering, telling people how they could read Genesis, you know, independently of what the theological tradition in the Catholic Church it had to say, and, you know, that brought us the Reformation, and look at all those crazy Protestants, you know, and all the different denominations they gave rise to, right? They didn't like that, right? That's what went on. That's why it was such a sticking point there. They became much more kind of narrow in terms of the range of permissible interpretations that they would allow. And, you know, in the case of Darwin, you had this whole modernist controversy in Protestant theology. You had higher biblical criticism coming out of Germany and elsewhere, and people espousing very non-orthodox theological views. And people were thinking, you know, that the center's not holding here. We're getting all kinds of, you know, totally non-orthodox kind of views. And then in this context, now we got Darwin coming along and adding more fuel to the fire, as they saw. And, you know, this was a big issue. But those storms have long since passed. And there is no reason for evangelical Christians not to reclaim the long, very long tradition of Christian theology would have Christians study God's two books, Nature and Scripture, Bacon's image, together in order better to honor their common author, an infinitely wise and most worthy to be praised being. Thanks.